Yeah, I'll come on in, Howard. Thanks. Oh, that was a very interesting talk. So thanks ever so much. I know you're skilled at doing this sort of thing. So yeah, but all the same, it was very interesting. So thank you. And as you know, I also am an admirer of Bob Dylan. And I thought that was I don't want to talk about Bob Dylan in particular, but just to use the metaphor of Bob Dylan really as a something we could sort of explore a little bit further, hopefully not too much further, but just a bit. And I was interested that obviously you went to see him recently, and he's 84 now, and your son bought the ticket, so you went there just to please your son, I suppose, as well as probably please yourself. But he was at Wolverhampton not very long ago as well, and I just wasn't interested to see him because I also thought, well, he's an old man now, you know. Good luck to him, you know. I'm not going to knock him for keeping on, you know, with it, but I wasn't especially interested in going to a concert where, as you said, like, you know, everybody would be there really just to Bob worship, you know, and so on. However, having said that, I did see Bob Dylan, I think in Birmingham about 15 years ago or something like that, and I was expecting the worst, but he was absolutely great. You know, the act was really good. He wasn't doing like the strumming guitar sort of thing. He had a keyboard and a very small piece band, and it was very stripped back. And he didn't really do any of the old standards. You know, it was a good show, I felt. And that was the last time I saw him. I've seen him a couple of times before that, some decades ago. But the point really that I wanted to make about this was that, you know, you say, well, people sort of, I don't want to, you know, sort of put words back into your mouth, Howard, but it was like, you know, people sort of see him as some sort of messiah or sort of so on. I think, to be really honest, I think Dylan has been seen like that really in many ways, because if you cast your mind back, as you were there, I wasn't. Well, I was actually. I was born, but I wasn't really. You know, I wasn't going to gigs. The 60s, Dylan was a real cultural sort of marker for a certain element in Western society. You know, he influenced a lot really of you know, the new social movements and the student movements and things like that. And he did actually sort of sing quite effective songs against, you know, what was going on in Vietnam and the old sort of, you know, this was in the beginnings of the new forms of society really in within capitalism, the breakup of the working class really into more kind of like groups, you know, women's lib and gay liberation and you know, all sorts of, you know, the black power movements and things like that. Dylan was a sort of expression of that really, probably from a white left leaning liberal perspective. Albeit, you know, quite effective at the time. And you've also got to understand as well, I think, a lot of people probably have become aware of Dylan later on, you know, younger people. They just think, you know, oh, he's quite an important sort of person. And I'd like to see him, you know, be able to sort of say, oh, I saw Bob Dylan before he snuffed it, you know, basically. There's a lot of that around as well. So I just thought that was interesting. I've got other things I could comment on and say about other aspects of the talk, but I just thought I'd respond to the Bob Dylan bit really to begin with. So yeah, thanks. It was great. Yeah, cheers.
Thanks, Andy. Thanks very much indeed. Okay. Mike, over to you.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks for a very interesting talk. Yeah, it's very well put together and lots of yeah, sort of, you know, decent examples as well with the slideshow that helped to bring it to life. I With what you were saying about sort of, you know, the hero or heroine worship side of the entertainment industry. I think you're what you're saying applies to lots of people in lots of situations, but I don't think it's sort of universal in how people tend to react to music in a quite sort of obsessive way. And maybe I'll, you know, put my cards on the table with my own sort of fannish credentials, which might explain my point of view on this. I mean, with the band Sparks, I've probably seen them live more than 50 times with some gigs coming up. And you know, obviously, you know, got all their albums, and you know, but when I go on to the gigs, you know, meet up with a few people, have a few drinks, you know, sort of see a different place, part of the country. But I don't really sort of regard it as hero worship in maybe quite the way that you were explaining. And of course, you know, this is sort of subjective and personal, and obviously sort of doesn't apply to anyone and everyone. I think it's, yeah, sort of certainly appreciating a band's you know, sort of music, songs, atmosphere, and everything. And obviously that's also obviously sort of filtered through the sort of the commercial market that bands have to operate in. But I think, as I said sort of last week, that doesn't necessarily always manifest itself in an alienating way in terms of seeing the artist as superior, in the same way that we're supposed to see the capitalist class as superior, and the capitalist class is superior in a sort of structural way. And I'm aware you didn't sort of make a connection between superiority and the sort of hero worship sense of following a musician, but I do think it's a different kind of hierarchy to that which exists in a more sort of you know, in a sort of capitalist way. And I don't think, yeah, it's not necessarily sort of worshipping a person. Obviously, worship's a very sort of loaded word to use there. It's and obviously it is sort of personified, where people focus on, you know, Taylor Swift's fashion or body or you know, more sort of material aspects of an artist. But yeah, you know, I think you can appreciate the artist's sort of music, as I say, you know, vibe in a way which it isn't as always as alienating as maybe you were saying. But as I say, I think what you're saying certainly does explain a lot of sort of phenomena, like, you know, sort of boy bands, girl bands, that kind of obsessive behavior there, which is obviously very calculated in a commercial kind of way. But yeah, I don't think it always applies. Anyway, yeah, thanks very much. Yeah, cheers. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. I don't disagree with any of that, actually. I mean, I think there's a similar things can be said about, it came up briefly in last week's discussion about sport. I mean, it isn't the case that just because you support a particular football team or like a particular player, you worship them. Some people do, a lot of people do, which is unfortunate, but a lot of people don't as well. There are different ways of perceiving these things. I definitely don't hold it against you that you keep going to Sparks concerts and think that you're some kind of obsessive. No, not at all. Okay. Right. Freddie now.
Yeah, thanks, Howard. Yeah, interesting talk. And in truth, Mike Foster echoed many ways the thoughts that I was going to express there about the words, you know, using the words worship and such like, and cult worship. There may well be some to that effect. So I don't think that can be denied. But what I will comment on is that when I was living in Glasgow, and in Glasgow branch, regularly after our meetings, whatever it was we were holding them on a Saturday, we'd go to the pub, etc., and there'd be a lot of folk music on, a lot of good folk singers in the pubs at the time there. Also, quite invariably at times, we'd go back to some comrade's house to listen to music after the pub. And Bob Dylan was the number one that was on there all the time. Now, you know, I couldn't say that Cumbria's worshipped him in any way, but they certainly admired their music. And you can say that Bob Dylan, for example, was probably in the right place at the right time. Because in addition to Bob Dylan, he had people like Leonard Cohen. I'm quite an admirer of Leonard Cohen, and I still listen to Bob Dylan quite a lot also. So, but this question of worshipping, etc., I'm not wholly convinced about it. And in terms of football, I mean, if I said, for example, I think he's dead now, but a Celtic player, Jimmy Johnson, I think he was one of the best players I've ever seen. In fact, George Best was almost as good as him. I'm just throwing that in for a bit of controversy, that Jimmy Johnson was better than George Best. So there are people, and whilst I've followed Celtic since I was being about 9, 10 years old, I don't worship them either, though, in any way. So I think just a degree of caution about this this sort of worship. And some people, I'm sure we've got some exceptionally talented artists in the party. I could regard myself in my younger days as quite a piss artist, to tell you the truth, which I quite enjoyed at the time. But now that I'm older and wiser, it's not the same. So, yeah, interesting. But Mike did, in many ways, express what I was going to express. But I just thought I'd get my talking worth in about Bob Dylan, because I actually saw him. And I think it was 66 or 67. I think it was the Odeon in Glasgow. And I saw him there. And I thought it was brilliant, really good. And I think Brian Ferry's really good as well. But I thought you might like that one also, Mike. And Freddie Mercury. Okay, I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Thanks very much for that. Yeah, I mean, look, I've been a Bob Dylan fan since now. I started listening to Bob Dylan in 1962, I'm afraid, and I've been to a number of his concerts over the years, and I don't feel that any of those concerts there was the kind of sort of cult feeling that I experienced several weeks ago in the concert I went to. I think it's something that's sort of developed quite dramatically with this. In the way that sort of in capitalism, money and fame, you know, does build these things up. I mean, you know, Dylan was not the cult figure, the sort of hero, if you like, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, that he is now. It's something that's sort of, you know, almost been thrust upon him. You know, he got this, he got the Nobel Prize for Literature, probably deserved it actually, in one way or the other. But I just, you know, there was something different about the concert I went to. You know, people were almost worshipping him in a way that they might worship a deity, and it was something that sort of struck me as unhealthy anyway, if you like. Especially given that the music was, oh heavens, you know, if you were coming there, never heard of Bob Dylan before. You were coming to see a music concert by somebody who's reputed to be absolutely sort of, you know, a world class performer. You would have been bitterly, bitterly disappointed. If you knew his music already and you knew the kind of thing he does with his music on stage, well, all right, you can sort of, you know, that can be part of the way you actually perceive it. You know, this is something that's developed quite dramatically, I think, over the last 10 or 15 years, as it has with, you know, other stars, if you like, of stage and screen. It's something that's, you know, far, far more prevalent now than it was, say, 30, 40 years ago. Okay, Moggy, you've got your hand up. Over to you. We're not hearing you, Moggy, I'm afraid. Moggy, we're not hearing you, although you seem not to be muted. Any reason? No? You don't show us being muted. Has this happened before? I don't think so.
Happened last week, I think.
Oh, there we are. Oh, sorry, no, no. Who was that? Is that Joy?
No, it's me. It's, I think Moggy had trouble getting through last week, although she was unmuted. We couldn't hear her.
Right, I see. Yeah, we're not hearing you, I'm afraid, Moggy. That's a bit problematic. Okay, should we pass over to Paddy? See, I don't know whether you can see if you can do something about it in the meantime. You show us being muted now, but... Yeah, okay. Paddy, then over to you.
Oh, I'm guessing there's something about Moggy's computer that's disabled the microphone. You might have to get someone to look at that. It's easy to do those things by accident, actually. I did something similar myself just the other day. Just on what you were saying, Howard, interesting stuff. You have a big broad sweep of history and prehistory there. A number of other people have sort of said what I was thinking, which is, was a bit sceptical, you know, how far you could go with this sort of hero worship and, you know, putting artists on pedestals and abject expression of powerlessness and manifestation of alienation. I thought maybe you're laying it on a bit thick there in some cases. I think the thing about, lots of people have talked about Dylan, and I dare say your experience was right, but I'm guessing that since you've been seeing Dylan since 1962, it wasn't always like that with him. And I imagine what it is now is, I'm a bit surprised you didn't mention the Nobel Prize for Literature. I think that's changed him into a sort of piece of living history. I bet for a lot of young people now, going to see a Dylan concert, it'd be like going to see Einstein live. You know, that's the sort of iconic status that he's got now. Taylor Swift's concerts can be measured on seismographs because of how many people are stamping their feet to her music. This sort of thing. These people are, they're not just sort of artists. They're, in a way, I mean, lots of teachers say that Taylor Swift has had a really good influence on Generation Z, Generation Alpha kids, because of her lyrics. She's promoting all the right kinds of social values that we would encourage as well. She's been a really good influence. She knows how to speak the language of the young. I'm not a big Swiftie, by the way. This is just what I've read. A bit like Dylan, they know, you know, the two of them, they know how to communicate profound truths in common language. There's an old saying that something goes along the lines of, a poet is someone who can explain to me what I'm feeling in better words than I could. And I think that's true of people like Dylan and Taylor Swift, and quite a few, and somebody mentioned Leonard Cohen as well. This ability to communicate profound truths is hugely praiseworthy, and it is hugely admirable, because it's rare. Not many people can do it. And so people like that do earn reputation. They deserve, you know, they deserve plaudits for it, because in some way they're putting some positive influences into the social zeitgeist. So I don't know. I suppose I'm just saying some of these people get the admiration they deserve, and it doesn't mean that we're all alienated zombies because, you know, we admire them. The other thing I thought that you might mention when we were talking about, people being famous, was people who are famous for only being famous, reality stars. I thought you might have mentioned the Kardashians and people like that, and modern day influencers who just want to be famous for the sake of being famous. That just seems to be a very odd kind of manifestation of advanced capitalist values, which I think we can probably all agree certainly wouldn't exist into socialism. but the actual admiration for people of very rare gifts or qualities or a single-minded determination to become the best at something, I think that probably would continue into socialism, and why not? It's a sort of part of the human condition to, for a lot of people, to want to be really good at one thing. Most of us are good at sort of, what was the thing I heard the other day about, most people's knowledge is a mile wide and an inch deep. And yeah, I think that's fair. I'm quite happy at that. But there are certain people who just want to focus on one thing and create a very sort of deep level of adeptness at it. And, you know, fair enough. Anyway, that's all I was going to say.
Thanks, Paddy. Very well said. Maybe I should have mentioned the Kardashians. There aren't many profound truths there, that's for sure. Of the kind there are, I agree, in someone like Dylan. I can quote half a dozen lines right away which contain such truths. And that's great, you know. I mean, as I say, I think he was a rightful receiver of the Nobel Prize for Literature. It's just that I felt that the concert I went to and the concerts he's doing, the people who were there were not there for profound truths. I mean, they wouldn't have sort of picked them up even if he'd sort of come out with them, which on the whole he didn't. I don't think there are many profound truths in his more sort of recent song, that's for sure. But perhaps I should have delved more deeply into this celebrity culture, which consists of people like the Kardashians, social influences and others. Yeah, okay, yeah, that, yeah, yeah. No, I'm happy to accept that I perhaps laid it on a bit thick, but it was to sort of, you know, to make a particular point. And I do agree with you that in a socialist society, people will cease, you know, will continue to try and be the sort of best they can at the fields they're talented in. Yeah, they will, and they should as well. It's just a pity, you know, more people can't do that in the society we live in currently.
Howard, right. Howard, yeah. I don't know how to put my hand up. I'm sorry. Do you mind? Can I jump in now?
Yeah, jumping on. Yeah.
Well, I heard on the news this evening that Harry Styles, I'm sure we've all heard of Harry Styles, I can't remember the name of the band he was in, but he's become the biggest thing ever. Now, he's a very ordinary bloke with a very ordinary voice. I'm thinking of the thousands of people who have got more talent, who never make it, who work in terrible jobs, and they just weren't there at the right time. And it seems that this explosion of talent that there could be is so restricted, and we do have a cult of worship. Do you remember the 60s when the Beatles performed? The girls were screaming so hard, you couldn't hear the music.
Yeah.
And there's no doubting that Elvis Presley, even after he came out of the army, when his music was absolute shite, was still a huge idol and people worshipped him. And I think you can say that for so many other, Paddy mentioned the Kardashians. I have to put in a comment here that you don't know, you, Howard, my love, don't know anything about the Kardashians, so you weren't going to mention them. But we can't really get away from this idea of the cult. There are cult followings, and it is a question of people have no faith in themselves, so they put all their sort of emotional input into these, what I call, non-entities. You've only got to look on Facebook or whatever to see Victoria and David. We don't even need to give them a surname. She's just had an award from the Cultural Institute of Paris. What for? For being somebody with a big nose and married to a footballer. I mean, you know, you can't really say there isn't a cult value. I mean, of course, we love people for what they do, their music and Leonard Cohen, Dylan, whatever. But so many of these people have no talent at all. It's all produced in a laboratory, but they just happen to have an image and they will make money. Their image is selling them. They're making money from merchandise. I mean, I've heard that they make more from merchandise sales at concerts than they do from the sale of tickets. Sorry, I'm getting a bit excited. I'll go now.
thanks for coming to my rescue, Joy. Okay. Right. Couldn't agree more with what you just said, quite honestly. All right, Freddie, back to you again.
Yeah. I'm not surprised that Joy was getting excited, all that talk about Bob Dylan there. That'd be enough to excite anyone, really, to tell you the truth. However, if I'm misrepresenting what you said, that this sort of cult type worship, etc., you know, the Swifties and such like, I think Joy actually made the point that I was going to make, and I was going to pull my hand down, but just on the safe side, that, you know, I remember back in the 60s, obviously, because, you know, we're in the same age group, the Stones and the Beatles, etc. Tamla Motown was a big thing. So are you suggesting that there wasn't that still sort of cult type then? Because it's not relatively new, really, is it? I mean, if you go back to, dare I say it, people like Bill Haley and the Comets, I remember somebody telling me about them. I don't remember them exactly myself. But, you know, there's always been that. And Joy also mentioned Elvis, for example. So there's always been that, people that have got some talent. I didn't think, me personally, because as you yourself have said, you, to some extent, beauty in the eye of the beholder, and music likewise, you know, as to what is really good music. You know, we could all have a difference of opinion on that. But I don't believe that this sort of enjoying somebody's music to a great extent is new. So if I've misunderstood you, forgive me, but I got the impression that a couple of times that this was a relatively new phenomenon. And I can remember it at least 50 years ago getting on like that. So thank you.
I'd agree with that, Freddie. So I didn't mean to suggest it's a phenomenon of capitalism, I think, which has been going for, you know, for a lot more than just a few years. It's just that I picked on Dylan because I saw it there. But yeah, and I was saying that at an earlier stage, you know, I don't think that did apply to Dylan. But yeah, I agree with Joy that you saw it with the Beatles, where, you know, a whole stadium of women weren't listening, but they were sort of wetting themselves, etc. You saw it with Elvis Presley. And yeah, I do agree with that. Yeah, absolutely. It's been going for a long time. I notice, Andy's got his hand up, but I notice Maggie's put quite a long piece in the chat, given her the fact that, you know, we can't hear her. So perhaps I'll just read that out so Moggy gets her say. She says, "I was a big fan of Dylan in the 60s and 70s. I never thought of him as a singer. Let's face it, he has a lousy voice, but he could chant his poetry to the most wonderful, amazing backing group called The Band. He really appealed to folk singers because his words were worth listening to. His music today still has appeal to younger listeners as well as the older age group. My daughter plays in a Dylan tribute band called The Zimmermans, and I'm totally biased here, but I think they do Dylan better than Dylan. They draw huge crowds of all ages and have everyone jumping to their great sound. Last year, I took my daughter to see the film about Bob Dylan. I think it was called Like a Rolling Stone. Great film, I recommend it. Afterwards, my daughter commented on what an awful personality Dylan was. He was rude to everyone and treated his girlfriends abominably." Thanks, Maggie. Thanks for that. Okay. Right, okay, Andy, back to you now.
Well, thanks, Howard. Thanks, Moggy. That sounds brilliant. Having a daughter in a Dylan singing band, and also your appreciation of the band with Robbie Robertson and all those guys, you know, they were great. However, I'm seeking to shift the terrain now a little bit. I just want to may have a look at who's here tonight. I don't want to embarrass myself too much. Oh, Steve Finch is here. He's going to shoot me down in flames. But listen, guys, I am a cudgel, right? I have a band. I've had a band since I was, since I was about 14, really. But my band's called the Cudgels, and we've made records, and we used to go on little tours and things like that. Always incredibly independent, and but I've never made a big deal about it in the party. You know, it's just something I do as a sort of sideline, really. I've never made a penny from it, really. We're pretty cool. But the one thing about that is I can play the guitar and I can play a bit of piano and keyboard and I write songs and so on. And I was taking a break from my main day job there about three or four years ago. And just to give me something to do during this planned period when I just felt like a break. You know, I was lucky enough that I got a bit of money in the bank, and the job I had, I just got a bit fed up with it and I just needed a break. I did some teaching assistant work in a specialist school for young people with, you know, these days the term is special needs or additional needs, learning disabilities and behavioural difficulties and so on. And it was in a very deprived area of Walsall. And I used to go in, I said, I'll do 3 days a week and come in and just do what I can to help out. You tell me what to do. I'm happy to go along with it, you know. And anyway, it turned out this one day, fairly near to the point where I had to move on because I needed to get a proper job again, they put me with the music teacher. And the music teacher was the head teacher's daughter. And it was all a bit of a crazy kind of, nepotistic sort of situation in this school. But all the teachers were like, all, you know, they all knew what was going on and everything like that. And I didn't get involved in that. Anyway, the heel of the hunt, this music teacher was saying to me, oh, it's so difficult to get these kids engaged. They won't engage. You know, I'm trying to teach them music and it's so difficult. I mean, we've got a harp and we've got a piano and whatever. So I said, have you got a guitar? And she said, we've got a couple of guitars and we've got a couple of little ukuleles. So I said, okay, have you got any other things that the kids can bang and, you know, just rattle and do anything, you know. And if they can't, can they bang on the tables and whatever, you know, clap their hands. All right. She said, yeah, okay. What do you want to do then, Mr. Davis? I said, well, let me try something out. So I gave the kids any little bit of percussive instruments and things like that that they could have. And I said, give me the guitar. And I said to the kids, I said, now, I'm Mr. Davis. I'm rock and roll, okay? I said, this is a G. Went like that. That's a C. That's a D. I said, any more chords than that, and it's jazz, you know? So anyway, I'll get to the heel of the hunt. I said, right, we're going to do a song. Froggy went a-courting. Every time I get to the end of a verse, I say, aha. You have to go, aha. Okay, so it was. I don't want to sing it right here and now, but what I'm trying to get at is what Howard was saying. It was about communal music making, you know. So it was like Froggy went to courting and he did ride aha, and the kids would go aha. By the end of the song, they were all banging the tables and all the rest of it, and it just so happened before the end of the session, the music teacher's mother, who was the head teacher at the school, walked by, put her head in and saw what was going on. And she said to, after we'd finished, she said to her daughter, hey, Margaret, where do you get these guys from? And I just come in and just did what I was just natural. It didn't matter to me. It was just like I was a volunteer. And I just think that says a lot about how you can just be natural and not care and just get kids involved, just let your hair down. And that was, to me, that was a really important thing. I'll never forget that. And I was praised up very a lot then by everybody concerned. They said, oh, we can we do it again so we can video it to show it to the board of governors, you know. So I'm not sure how relevant that is, Howard, but it's about how like, you know, you lose your inhibitions when you do music together with other people. Ronnie Lane, the great Ronnie Lane, who was in the Small Faces, said, you know, if you can play a musical instrument, you'll always have a friend. Something I've never forgotten, really. Anyway, I've took up enough time. Thanks. You're muted, Howard.
Okay, sorry about that. Right. Thanks for that, Andy. Yeah, an interesting story, definitely. Yeah, and it is illustrative of something. One of the things I mentioned anyway in the talk, definitely. Can we have Anya now, Mike, if that's okay, because he's not spoken yet. Over to you, Anya. Hey, can you unmute Anya?
Yes.
I've just reinstalled,
so I had to okay. Put my permissions back on. So what was I going to say? Yeah, so I want to talk a little bit. We're mainly talking about music, so that we'll stick to music. So with the punk rock, it was like punk rock, and there was hip hop, and they both kind of emerged. They were both quite political musical movements where money wasn't really sort of that important, you know. And arguably, some people would say probably the style wasn't that, or the talent wasn't that important either. And it was based around community and things. And both of those things came out of like, destitution in New York, when New York, when the city was being defunded, the banks weren't giving the New York City their loans. And New York was sort of, you know, really run down. And of course, London as well under Thatcherism. And sort of these were forms of rebellion, you know, both hip hop, punk rock. And some other things as well. You guys all lived through it. I didn't. This is I'm a bit younger. Not all of you. Sorry, but you know, these were political movements movements that came, that were inherently political. And of course, they'd be sort of defanged now. You sort of see you can sort of see these. These sort of like formerly very political sort of punk bands are now still touring with huge crowds and things like that, rather than being in sort of a dive bar in the basement of somewhere. Or you know, hip hop has become, you know, massive. It's huge, and it's you know, of course, originally when it started, it was you know, a political movement, you know, and it wasn't about the money or anything like that. So in a way, it kind of makes our case for us, you know, to say that, you know, you can't have pockets of freedom within capitalism. It's always going to, you know, capitalism is always insidious. You know, the profit motive always gets into everything, everywhere. You know, eventually those punk bands get a manager. You know, they end up, you know, going into recording studios. They have to like formulate business rather than having to be, you know, like 50p on the door or whatever. So, yeah. And both of those things came out of alienation. They were both spawned by alienation, you know, and the American punk rock too. And yet, you know, but it was very individualistic. So it was very much, you know, it was a very individualistic movement. And as such, they no longer have the power. The political power that they used to hold. And in fact, arguably, the music's not as good as it was then, because of course, you know, we all still love all the classic hip-hop tracks, we all still love all the classic punk tracks, but of course the stuff that's coming out now is just, you know, absolute garbage. So yeah, that's what I wanted to sort of tie political slant to talk about political music a little bit. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Anya. Thanks very much. Yeah, what happens, I suppose, with these movements is that in the end, the lucky ones sort of, in a sense, follow the money. That's what happens. You know, it's the kind of thing that Christopher Biggins was talking about with acting. You know, some very, very good people never get work because they're unlucky one way or the other. And there's only work for them if somebody can find a way of making money out of them. That's right, yeah. Okay, Mike, back to you then.
Yeah, cheers. Yeah, I think maybe sort of the music industry has been a bit more sort of resilient in terms of how sort of the capitalist sort of economy has sort of ebbed and flowed over the last 100 or so years. And you know, of course, you know, back in the 50s, it was communicated through, you know, records and then the radio and then, you know, later CDs and now, of course, you know, sort of downloading and streaming. And obviously all of those have been profitable in various ways, and but they've sort of survived. And I think, you know, live music has, again, still been quite resilient in terms of it's sort of still managed to be there, you know, as well as obviously you've got the big sort of ultra commercial stadium gigs, which are obviously very profitable. But yeah, you know, you still get sort of medium sized bands and things that still sort of surviving and playing. So I think, I suppose, yeah, the music industry has managed to sort of adapt to the vagaries of the capitalist economy in maybe ways which other sort of outlets for art and entertainment haven't. You know, cinema is being sort of eroded by you know, sort of Netflix, and you know, sort of YouTube channels have again, they're sort of impacting on TV, you know, traditional broadcast TV consumption. And you know, the traditional channels, BBC, are very much sort of threatened. They're on the down trajectory, whereas other forms of media are on the sort of, you know, the more profitable, you know, they're rising. But I think all of this, and especially the impact of the sort of digitization of art and entertainment, means that things are in some respects a bit less communal, in that you don't get the same sort of people going to the cinema in quite the same way as you used to. You still do, you know, Oppenheimer and Barbie were very popular at the cinema. But yeah, my other point was that the way that modern technology is impacting on how we consume art and entertainment is affecting the content of art and entertainment. There was something I saw ironically on a YouTube channel about how film producers are now structuring the scripts of some of their dramas to take into account that people are going to be scrolling through their phones while they're watching a film. So the script will regularly repeat plot points for the benefit of people who might have missed them the first time round because they were checking their X thread while they're watching. And again, there's videos on YouTube about declining literacy rates because kids can't be bothered to read books anymore because they're just scrolling through stuff on their mobiles. So I think, yeah, again, obviously all this is sort of market driven, you know, according to what's profitable. But I think, yeah, there are other ways in which capitalism and the profit motive are shaping music and its quality, as well as the whole sort of commercialization and sort of hero worship angle of it. So, yeah, just wanted to quickly chuck that in. Yeah, thank you.
Howard, is it okay if I jump in again?
Yes, do, by all means. Yeah.
Right. Well, I wanted to say about, let's say, about art in the sense of painting, visual arts. I mean, all it takes is for a Charles Saatchi to buy something like My Unmade Bed, for Tracy Emin to become the greatest artist in living history. Okay. Damien Hirst, exactly the same. And what people do is they buy this stuff as an investment. It's got nothing to do with the artistic merit of the actual work. It becomes an investment. And you hear time and time again about people who are buying... I mean, who's that American guy who buys art as... he does a programme about how you make money out of buying art. It's no longer the actual work itself, the beauty of it. Think of Van Gogh, who died in poverty, produced the most beautiful works of art ever, and now they're selling for trillions of pounds. You know, it's become purely commercial. And just to be sort of really horrible to Anton or Anya, the Sex Pistols were totally manufactured by Malcolm McLaren. What can we do next that's going to shock people? It's going to really sort of take the world by storm, and it's going to make loads of money. I mean, need I say more? Well, I could.
Thanks, Joe. That's very much okay. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, very interesting points there. Yeah, very interesting indeed. Okay. Right, we're sort of coming towards the end. Andy, you've got your hand up again. So given that you're alone with your hand up, we'll hear you again. Okay.
Thanks, Howard. Appreciate that. And actually, I wanted to move on just a little bit. And I thought the art market discussion was very, very interesting. Something, you know, this is such a broad topic that you've introduced. It's so interesting. But before I make my point about the art market, also I would agree with iPad 3.
Joy,
yeah, with joy. about the punk rock scene. I've got friends who were very influential in that early sort of area of that punk scene. One of my good friends is a woman called Shan Bradley, who was the bass player in a band called the Nipple Erectors, who was, when she was at art school, booked the Sex Pistols for their first gig. And Shan and I are still in touch with each other. I don't know if anybody knows my Facebook page, but it's not under my real name. But there are lots of recent pictures of myself and Shan together. But I totally agree how punk rock was commercialised. However, the point I wanted to just come on to was about art and visual art, and in particular this sort of niche around the sort of idyllic English countryside and the way that was portrayed. And when I was growing up, there were pictures by Constable, the Hay Wayne, and things like this, and other artists as well of that ilk. But I read a very, very interesting article. I just wanted to give a little bit of a plug here to a an online, well, it's basically a little online journal. It's very, very interesting. The style of the journalism is brilliant, I think. It's called Dispatch. And they did an article on a plagiarist called Tom Keating, who was well known in the sort of 70s and 80s. And he was somebody that could paint in the style of those landscape artists. And basically, he ripped off the whole art scene, and he was lucky. He didn't go to jail for it, but he became a sort of a bit of a villain of the art scene, really, because he showed up how the art scene was essentially just something that was, you know, turned into a monetized thing, you know, pieces of art were just turned into money. And he was apparently, he called himself a Marxist. So I'm sure that some of us around here would remember Tom Keating from that time. So just thought his story was so interesting. And this little journal that I've started reading called Dispatch, who is actually it's written by somebody I knew once upon a time when they were incredibly young, because I looked after them as a child, which I will disclose now. I think I've got my nerve. It's Frank Faraday's son, and he's called Jacob Faraday, but what he writes is nothing like what his father does. It's really quite nice and quite interesting. So, yeah, I think you should get into it.
Thanks, Andy. Okay. Right, well...
It just goes to show, Andy. Tom Keating was a brilliant artist. It just goes to show that, you know, you can do it.
Yeah, he was a brilliant artist.
People didn't realise for years that he was a faker.
I know.
It's pretty amazing, actually.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, okay. Right, it's exactly 9 o'clock, so we've sort of reached full time, unless anybody else wishes to make any kind of contribution. Thanks, everyone, for listening and contributing. I don't know where perhaps somebody, Adam or Paddy, can tell us what we've got next week.
Yeah, it's the discussion on the news. So we'll be discussing, the war in Iran or the oil crisis when Iran blocks the Straits of Hormuz. But anyway, it's going to be on the, according to the formula that Freddie favours. We just turn up and start talking and hope we keep talking till 9 o'clock.
Thanks, Adam. Okay, thanks very much indeed. Right, thanks everyone for coming, and see you all next week. Cheers.
And thanks, Howard, for doing the talk.
Thank you. Bye.
Cheers. Good night, all.